wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio. It's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this January 18th Monday, the day we celebrate Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday, a federal holiday first observed in the U.S. nationwide in 1986. This morning on the Old Mole, we take up the issues that define our struggles, past and present, the fight to preserve and expand democracy, investment in the health and well-being of all Americans, and the critical role liberation politics must play in anti-racist movements. Bill Resnick talks with Tara Hurst of the Oregon Health Justice Recovery Alliance about Measure 110. Measure 110 by far leads the national efforts to decriminalize drugs and offer treatment for addiction. Bill and Tara discuss Measure 110's significance and what must be done to implement it. Jan Hawken talks with Destiny Houston about the Inaugurate Justice Rally, March, and Caravan that will be held on Wednesday, January 20th at Irving Park in Portland. That's at 4 o'clock to 7 p.m. Houston is an organizer with Kids Center March for Black Lives and is a member of the Defend Democracy Coalition that is organizing the Inaugurate Justice event. We conclude today's program with Sky Wilson interviewing Kent Ford, co-founder of the Portland chapter of the Black Panther Party. They talk about the role of the radical Black tradition in our world today. This interview was produced by Old Mole Desiree Helligers. And Sky Wilson is new to KBOO and the Old Mole. Sky has been a member of the Clark County community since 2007, and for nearly two decades, his research and work has focused on community organizing and local communities creating alternative community-based structures. I am Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks for tuning in this morning, and thanks to KBOO members, old and new, for supporting community radio and programs like the Old Mole. Remember, you can find us on the web. Look for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. And now, Bill Resnick and Tara Hurst.
Tara Hurst, welcome to KBOO.
Thanks, Bill. I'm excited to have this conversation with you.
Tara Hurst is director of the Oregon Health Justice Recovery Alliance. Tara has been the director of Renew Oregon. She worked with the Measure 11 campaign that fought for Measure 110 in Oregon in the excitement of the November 3rd election. It didn't make national headlines, but Measure 110 did something enormously important that no state had ever attempted. What happened? Oregon voters, nearly 60% of them, decriminalized the possession of small amounts of not just marijuana, but also what are known as the hard drugs. And Measure 110 also provided funds for increased drug treatment. Tara was hired on to lead the Oregon Health Justice Recovery Alliance. It's a 65-member coalition. It's working to ensure that Oregon's new law is implemented fully and without delay, and centers on the needs of communities most harmed by the war on drugs: Black, Latinx, Native and tribal communities. James Baldwin and Martin Luther King Jr. warned about the drug wars, how it would be used to control Black communities. So first, Tara Hurst, I read some on your personal history. How did it inform your work on dealing with drug addiction and drug use? And tell us the goals of Measure 110.
I'm a person in long-term recovery, and what that means is that I have been alcohol and drug-free for 24 years now. And so coming into this work is not just meaningful and exciting for the state of Oregon, as you said, got recognition around the world. It has the opportunity to be such a transformative policy in communities, but it's also really personal to me. I struggled with addiction and with depression, and I really didn't think that I could live without using alcohol and drugs. And now I'm in a space where I'm able to give back to the community that was so fundamental in me being alive today and me being able to have the life that I have. So it's a complete honor to be able to lead this work in Oregon. Just from a personal standpoint, I think that the more that we can start talking about our stories and shedding light on who struggles with drug addiction, everybody knows somebody in their community or their family, if it's not themselves. It's really critical that we reduce the stigma and the harmful language around substance use. The Measure 110 is a really incredible piece of legislation and is now law in Oregon. It became enacted on December 3rd. And what it does is, as you said, it decriminalizes personal possession of small amounts of drugs. And what that does for folks is it really helps reduce the barriers that so many people face when they are charged with these low-level offenses. It may not be a lot of time, but what it does is it gives you a record and it's harder to access employment and housing and exacerbates kind of the trauma that you're already in when you're in an active addiction. What this does, instead of going to jail, it is a warm handoff to peer mentors who will be on a phone line to ensure that you are given opportunities to receive services that can help you stay safe and ultimately hopefully get you on a path to thrive. And that can be anything from intensive outpatient services, safe housing, because a lot of times it's really about making sure that you can get out of the situation you're in. It's talking to peers. You know, one of the things that helped me and has helped so many folks is really talking to people who understand what you've been through and what kind of the depth of an addiction can take you to, and somebody who has been able to stop using drugs and alcohol or who has been able to create a life for themselves, having those conversations and being able to start working through whatever it is that you need to get through some of the trauma that you've experienced. It's also about making sure that we're helping folks who, what they call harm reductions. Too many people are being admitted to the hospital because of infections from dirty needles. We've had an increase in overdose deaths in Oregon from April and May this year. It was 70% more overdose deaths. And, you know, these are statistics that, you know, for me personally, I've had friends die of overdoses. And these aren't just statistics that go out on an organizational or a government website. These are people's family members, they're their loved ones. And we have to do everything we possibly can to help people stay safe. And so what I think is transformational about this is not only that we're able to help alleviate the barrier of jail or a record, but also it's the next step of ensuring that we're funding a system of care, which in Oregon is embarrassingly and heartbreakingly low. So in Oregon, we're fourth in the nation for addiction rates, and we are at the bottom 48, 49, or 50, depending on who you ask, in access to services. We have more folks addicted and less opportunities to get them to where they need to be than any other state in the country. This is why we're seeing such dismal rates in overdoses and addiction. So I'm really excited because access to treatment for me is what worked, and it's why I'm able to have the life that I have today and the idea that I can work and help, you know, really make sure that others will have that when they are ready and when they need it, and that in the meantime, we can offer a whole variety of services and make sure that we're expanding services to those communities that are most harmed, as you talked about, from the war on drugs. And we know that those communities, not only were they most harmed, they also have the least access to care. So again, the worst of both situations, and it's time that Oregon makes up for that and really invests the majority of funds in those communities to make sure that we have culturally specific care ready and available when people need it.
Care measure 110 would reduce mass incarceration That's, of course, not the sole reason for mass incarceration. There are many reasons, but finding a few grains of something gives the police a chance to both threaten people with criminal sentences and get them then to guide them to things that the police want from them. Or they may just want to put the person away for whatever reason, because the person insulted them maybe or looked at them in the wrong way or wasn't completely obedient. A lot of people have gone to jail for sometimes long periods because there are long sentences and because they spoke up. That's going to be very greatly reduced. And it seems to me that the passage by almost 60% will also influence prosecutors and maybe even sent to treatment, maybe, or to a drug court or some other thing.
What the Criminal Justice Commission, which is a commission, did a study on what the impact would be on incarceration, especially those folks that are communities of color. What they found was that it would reduce racial disparities in drug arrests by 95% and reduce drug convictions of Black and Indigenous Oregonians by 94%. That's really monumental and really will help us as we're all calling to eliminate racist systems and to move us from these racist policies that we know are intentional and are harming folks. Arrests can break apart families, and people convicted of misdemeanor drug possessions can be jailed for 364 days and fined $6,000. And like we said before, it's a lifelong criminal record. So mass incarceration, we've got a long way to go, but this is a really great step that Oregon took. And I think that the message that it sends is addiction is a public health crisis. It's not a criminal justice crisis. And it's Oregon's role to show that you can move from prosecuting and pushing people into jail over drugs and actually move to a much more effective and humane way, which is that folks need help. And you're not finding that help in the criminal justice and the legal system. We were lucky that quite a few of our district attorneys have decided that they're not going to charge folks, and that's even before the decriminalization goes into effect, which is on February 1. We'll see. I think what this has shown is that more people believe that this is a health crisis than a criminal issue, and we're finally dealing with it in that manner, and we're taking a much more humane way to interact with folks who use substances.
Bill Resnick here on Cable Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Talking to Tara Hurst, the Executive Director of the Oregon Health Justice Recovery Alliance. Tara, work in the great effort to pass Measure 110 did something enormously important, decriminalized drugs, and also provided funds for increased drug treatment. Tara was then hired on to lead the Oregon Health Justice Recovery Alliance that is working to ensure that Oregon's new laws are implemented fully without delay, centering on the needs of the communities most harmed by war on drugs. So, Tara, Measure 110 was a great breakthrough. Actually, the margin of victory kind of shocked the nation. I am hoping that there will be copycat initiatives. Legislatures are afraid to act. But Oregon did what seemed impossible. This experiment now is going to be under the microscope. Its implementation, its outcomes on reducing drug crimes and deaths, its reduction, or maybe slight increase in drug use. People are going to be looking at that and fighting about that. So as the first in the nation, it's really important, it seems to me, to do it right. So, Tara, what are you folks now doing to make sure that things go right, that Measure 110 fulfills its promise?
So I think that we do recognize that we have a lot of scrutiny and it's critical to get it right. That's exactly why we are in existence, because there's a lot of work to be done and a lot of the details had already been figured out as the measure was progressing through the election by some of our state's smartest people who have been working on these issues and recovery services for decades. You know, what our role is to really ensure that the measure is funded fully to be effective. I think that until a law becomes a law, there's always people who have a lot of conjectures of what could happen and that the sky is going to fall. And it's our job to ensure that not only does the sky not fall, but we're making communities safer and we're helping people. And at the end of the day, it's critical that the legislature approves the funding that the voters overwhelmingly voted on to ensure that we have that warm handoff from police, from the criminal justice system to our peer mentors and to recovery services. And without that, you know, this can't be fully successful and fully actualized. And it's not what the voters voted on. The voters voted on a decriminalization with the money invested into a system that has been starved for so long that we're literally killing people in it. The work ahead for us, as you mentioned, we're actually now almost at 70 organizations that have signed on to this important work. And we're extremely proud to work alongside statewide organizations and also a lot of culturally specific providers to ensure that the money comes in and the funds are dispersed to our culturally specific providers first. We are working with the legislature. We're really educating legislators more on everybody's got a lot of stuff coming at them, and it's our job to make sure that they understand what the voters' intent was and why the measure came about, and then asking them to support the funding that the voters voted on. I think it's really great that voters wanted to see marijuana tax dollars go to recovery services and harm reduction services. It's a huge step for all of us. And so that's the work that we have ahead. You know, the governor's office and her recommended budget did recommend that the funding get pushed out until July of 2022. I don't think that they necessarily are held to that, and we've been having really good conversations with their policy folks to make sure that we can speed that up. It's completely unacceptable to delay funding when so many Oregonians are dying and struggling with substance use at this time, especially during COVID. And we're also seeing a huge shortage in our behavioral health and our providers because of COVID and budgetary constraints, and we can't afford to lose these critical frontline workers.
One issue, it seems to me, is really important, which is the quality and effectiveness of the treatment programs. In some states, some treatment programs have been set up that are really scams, especially they scam people with health insurance and charge the health insurance companies a lot of money for very little treatment, as well as ping-ponging of people. They try to keep people addicted, actually. And this happened in Florida. It was a multi-billion-dollar scam on the health insurance companies and on Medicaid. We can't allow that to happen. How is the law going to be implemented so that really effective programs get the money? And then secondly, I wonder to what extent do the 12-step programs like Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous, for a lot of people, that self-organized activity where people with drug problems are helping one another, are forming relationships, are sharing the emotional and intellectual problems they face and the challenges of staying the person they want to be. It seems to me an enormously effective modality. Tara, what kind of oversight is going to be done?
So that's a great question. There is an Oversight and Accountability Council that was written into the measure that the Oregon Health Authority is currently going through the applications. I know as of a week or so ago, they had over 150 applications from across the state. And what this accountability council is charged to do is make the rules around who gets the funds, what services are funded, and ensure that really most impacted communities from the war on drugs are the front of the line and get the majority of the funds. At least that's our intent. And then hopefully what the Oversight and Accountability Council will see as well. The reason it's so exciting is that this is a council that is heavily populated with people with lived experience. And as you can imagine, it's really important that we have folks who have actually gone through the criminal justice system, has struggled with this, or is a provider and works with folks who are in this cycle, and have them at the center of the decision making is pretty revolutionary. So that's happening right now. They're also heavily weighting their choices on ensuring that we have overrepresentation of BIPOC communities, so Black, Indigenous, and people of color. That's how the oversight and accountability is going to be happening. There's also, you know, mandates for the Secretary of State to do audits on who it's serving. Is the money going to the most effective spaces, and some other accountability measures, because it's critical that these dollars are spent in the best, most effective way possible that will help the most people. You know, you've mentioned AA and NA, and those are both great organizations. Those are self-governing and rely only on donations, and that's not necessarily for organizations that we are working with. I can say that for my own personal story, AA and NA were transformational for me. And really at the core of that, and why they were so transformational, I believe, is because it is all about peer-to-peer support, as we talked about before. And that's exactly what this measure is based on. And there's other ways for recovery and other programs that also utilize the power of peers. And that's really what the measure is doing as well. It's saying that instead of jail, we want folks getting connected to a peer. And sometimes it doesn't work the first, second, or third time when you're talking to a peer. But you create that connection and you plant that seed. And that's exactly what got me to the place when I was at my breaking point. I thought there was no other way to end the cycle than through taking my own life. And it was at that moment that I was able to utilize the information and the seeds that had been planted with me by a peer who was in recovery to get the help that I needed. And that's why I'm alive today. So I think the power of the peer, it's recognized as a evidence-based practice, and it's what is centered at the heart of this measure.
Tara Hurst, Executive Director of Oregon Health Justice Recovery Alliance, that's pushing in the legislature and the state to ensure that Oregon's new law, Measure 110, is implemented fully without delay. Tara, thanks so much for talking to us today. It was really great, and I know you're circulating a petition. How do people sign the petition?
We would love for folks to visit our website, which is healthjusticerecoveryalliance.org, and to sign up there, and they can stay involved and stay engaged. You know, you can visit us on social media as well, Health Justice Recovery, so that we can get you connected and you can help us in the fight to make sure that the funding goes through so that we can really transform our communities and get folks the help that they need.
Thanks so much.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM Community Radio. On Friday, January 22nd, 5 to 6:30 p.m., Portland State University and the Portland State University Foundation host an online panel on the 48th anniversary of Roe v. Wade. Panelist Loretta Ross, author of Radical Reproductive Justice, joins director Jan Hocken and physicians featured in the film Our Bodies, Our Doctors, and attorney Leah Rutnam with the ACLU of Washington. They map the road ahead for reproductive justice as the right-wing Supreme Court seems poised to overturn Roe v. Wade. For more information, go to the Road Ahead for Roe Facebook event page. We now turn to Jan Hocken in her role as an old mole, talking with Destiny Houston about the Inaugurate Justice rally, march, and caravan that will be held on Wednesday, January 20th. Jan?
Welcome to KABU, Destiny Houston.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
Destiny, you've been involved for some time with Kid-Centered March for Black Lives events, and you're a member of the Defend Democracy Coalition that is organizing a local event, Inaugurate Justice, at Irving Park in Portland, January 20th, 4 to 7 p.m. Before taking up the event plan for the day of the inauguration, can you tell us about the Defend Democracy Coalition and how this group formed during the November election?
Yes, absolutely. So it's pretty incredible. When we were coming up to the election, a group of people realized that either way, depending on if Trump was reelected or if Biden was elected, that there would be fallout from white supremacists and that it was important to develop a coalition. So a group of people started this and ended up getting 50 different organizations to sign on. And the focus is on being in a position to respond to white supremacy, to let people know that we are not going to stand for that in our city, and also to make a greater call nationwide to hold people accountable. And it is also because we intend to hold the Biden administration accountable since he's been elected. The focus will now be on holding the Biden administration accountable for climate change and taking action for our climate, for Black Lives Matter, for looking at indigenous rights. So the different things that are close to all of our hearts, those of us that truly care about the direction of our country.
And the tagline is many fights, same struggle. And you spoke about that struggle. You're one of the speakers at the November 4th Count Every Vote rally and march that was put on by the Defend Democracy Coalition. Can you say a bit more about why it's important for social justice, racial justice, climate justice groups, economic justice, a broad-based coalition of progressive organizations to come together specifically on the night of the inauguration, which I think is another important kind of a bookend to the first event on November 4th. Hopefully it'll be part of an ongoing series of actions. Why the night of the inauguration?
Again, focusing on the kind of the mission of the Defend Democracy Coalition is to show up for these big moments, to show support. I think it's so important that we hold an event for the inauguration so that people can see that we support the Biden administration, that we are going to start right off with Inauguration Day, holding them accountable. I also, for me personally, I look at it as a show of safety and love for the Black community and for the BIPOC community, who will bear the brunt of the fallout from white supremacists, even just in terms of having to be more alert, of being afraid, of having to witness so much hatred. So for me personally, holding an event on Inauguration Day is so important to let people know that, first of all, we're keeping our word. We are going to show up to defend democracy. We're going to hold the Biden administration accountable, and we're going to be there for the BIPOC community to show that, specifically to Portland, for instance, that love is going to win over hate in our city.
The concern about the right-wing siege on the Capitol last week and threats of violence, planned staging of various right-wing events around the inauguration. Sounds like you're saying we have power in numbers and in the strength of our vision.
Yes, absolutely. And yes, to touch on more specifically what you said, it's important for many different organizations to come together to form a coalition so that we're pooling resources and also narrowing our focus. It's been also amazing to watch that an organization is able to bring something forward and say, can we all get behind and support this? So there have been a few times where I've watched that be really powerful already. in the short time that this coalition has been together.
Can you speak to that whole dynamic of building a coalition? Because there's a broad social justice, progressive vision, and just as the right comes together in its own intersectional politics around anti-government, you know, white supremacy, other forms of racism, anti-immigrant, anti-Semitic, homophobic, sexist values, and an ideology that is very counter to what progressives hold dear. There are cross currents that bring progressive organizations together. But what do you think some of the points of cleavage or tension or issues that have to be worked through in building a coalition, a broad-based racial and social justice coalition?
That's a very good question. To truly build a strong coalition, of course, takes time. One of the major hurdles to get past is that when you come together as a coalition, many people have not worked together before. And under the circumstances we're currently living in with COVID, there is not an opportunity to be together in space and to really get to know each other in person, which even over Zoom, while that is helpful, there's just certain things you don't learn about a person online. So that's definitely one hurdle. And I would say, well, I see this as a hurdle, but also as something that's really positive for bringing a coalition together. For instance, centering Black lives. So when people are really passionate about their cause and their focus, it can be tricky, especially in Portland. You know, we're dealing with a mostly white city, and it can be difficult in Portland to elevate BIPOC voices and to make sure that in every single area that we care about as progressives, that we're centering Black lives and helping people see how everything is connected to centering Black Lives Matter and Indigenous rights and just the BIPOC community in general. So I feel like that in the climate we're in, there has been amazing support for that. And people are way more open to listening and to learning and to growing and finding a way to truly allow Black voices to be heard across all different areas of the progressive platform.
And that these dynamics emerge around, you know, when to have events, who's going to plan the program, who's going to speak, and various leadership roles. You were saying that a lot of this working through these tasks that people come together to take on as a coalition require a lot of patience and care and listening.
Yes, absolutely. Personally, I have really felt supported with the Defend Democracy Coalition. We're still growing and still finding our rhythm and still finding, we're still really working on centering BIPOC voices and reaching out and getting more organizations that focus on the BIPOC community involved, taking time and really making the space to look at things that could have been done differently and could be done better. So I really see a lot of hope in Defend Democracy, in the Defend Democracy Coalition, and it's definitely challenging.
And as you were saying, people meeting on Zoom rather than people coming together in a room over a cup of soup or a beer or whatever, you know, it adds its own challenges. And that's part of what's kind of remarkable about the period of time we're living in, like your work with the kid-friendly Movement for Black Lives events that involve a lot of support for communities, as well as events themselves, educationals before marches. This is a time of incredible and admirable creativity on the part of communities and movements, as well as something really depressing. It's both inspiring and depressing.
Yes, that sums up the state of the world right now.
It's kind of very bipolar. So can you describe what will happen that evening? This is Inaugurate Justice, organized by the Defend Democracy Coalition. It'll be at Irving Park. People will be meeting there from 4 to 7. That's 12th and Northeast Fremont. Can you describe what will happen that evening, including the plan for a caravan?
Yes. They are connected events, but they are really two separate events. So the march and rally will happen at 4 p.m. at Irving Park. People will gather at 4. There will be speakers and drumming and things that we've come accustomed to seeing at a rally before a march. Then there will be a march. So basically, really simple, 4 o'clock, there'll be a rally. 5 o'clock, we will march. We're trying to do something in a time frame that allows as many people as possible to participate. Then another beautiful thing is we are offering a car caravan for this event. Now, a car caravan is really fun. It will actually be staged and start at the PCC Cascade parking lot off of Killingsworth and Albina. That is where we will get everybody in line and ready to drive safely together. It's really fun to decorate your car, to have your kids or other family members that you're bubbled with in the car with you so that you can be, you know, yelling chants out the windows and waving at neighbors that come out to say hello. So we are offering the COVID and mobility option of the car caravan. And then we also have the march and rally at 4 p.m.
Okay, well, what a way to inaugurate. I love the title of this, Inaugurate Justice. We've still got our work cut out for us, right? But yes. We're stepping into a new moment of history, possibly with new possibilities as well as ongoing perils, as we know. Before we close, can you let people know where they can find out about and follow the plans for the Inaugurate Justice march and rally and caravan on the 20th? I know there is a Facebook page.
There is a Facebook page. There's also the Defend Democracy website. And
I think the Facebook page is Defend Democracy Coalition.
And we'll, sorry, we'll you got post. Me. I should have been ready for that question.
Well, I had it, but so we'll, but, so it will be there. Double information, and we'll also post it on our KBOO site. Destiny Houston, thank you so much for being with us today and for your work and the work of the coalition in launching this inauguration, this new administration, and pushing them, as we all need to do as a movement, toward a social justice platform and program. Thanks so much for being with us today.
And thank you so much for having me. Take a look at these hands. Take a look at these hands. The hand speaks. The hand of a government man.
We conclude today's program with Sky Wilson interviewing Kent Ford, co-founder of the Portland chapter of the Black Panther Party, about the role of radical Black tradition in our world today. Sky?
This is Sky Wilson for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I have the pleasure of being here today with Mr. Kent Ford, elder street fighting statesman. Mr. Ford is a founding member of the Portland chapter of the Black Panther Party, Portland Panthers. In 1969, he and other Portland Panthers helped organize the Fred Hampton Memorial People's Health Clinic. It extended free medical care 5 evenings a week, and the Malcolm X People's Dental Clinic, with providers seeing patients 3 evenings a week, and a free breakfast program at the Highland Community Church of Christ that fed up to 125 children a day. I want to say that last piece again. They worked and organized to feed 125 children a day. Welcome, Mr. Ford.
Thank you, Sky. Good to be here.
So, Mr. Ford, what do you see as the role of the radical Black tradition in our world today?
It was no longer to be the radical Black tradition, that be from the grassroots, everybody participate like we did since the murder of George Floyd last year. Everybody hit the streets, stay in the streets until, you know, we put stuff on the table, until defunding the police and tuition-free education or Medicare for all, until we get all the vaccines out to everybody and until we get everything done. This is our time now.
With that in mind, what is it about this time that you think has energized people to the degree that it has in this past year? You know, people taking to the streets, there's been this ongoing organizing and response in the street. What do you think it is about this time that has spurred that?
First of all, this fellow out to our left, George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, young man Blake, you know, and so we have to answer the call and get everything on the table and put everything on the table and deal with it. Defunding the police. It's the amount of people from all walks of life, you know, from Vancouver, Washington, Oregon. You know, it's time to move then.
Yes, sir. What do you see as the biggest barrier to realizing justice in our world today?
Okay, you had over 70 million people that voted for the other guy. Then as soon as the guy we went after, you know, he was talking about reach Obama. First time he was in the House and the Senate. And he still wanted to reach across the aisle. Oh, that's over with now. Your city ain't no good. Get up off of me. Move on with your agenda. You got the virus here. We got to get vaccines out to everybody. We got the homeless problem.
Thank you for moving us in that direction. Seems like this past year has been marked by a series of compounding crises, pandemic, the expressions of state violence, some of which you've already spoken to, Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, and the effects of global climate change, the smoke that saturated our space. What lessons has the COVID-19 pandemic revealed that we need to make sure we don't forget after it's over?
Thank you. You know the lady that wrote the book, The God of Small Things, Ira Dottie Roy?
Yes.
Well, she has an article when the virus first hit about a year ago. And she said, let this be a lesson that we don't be kicking everybody to the curb. The world belongs to everybody. It's a well thought out written article. You know, you can put it up in the Guardian. You can also pull it up in the Financial Times. That's where it first appeared in. Check that out. She lays it all out right there. Like she lays out everything.
Is that Arundhati Roy piece, the pandemic is a portal?
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's the piece, young man. Thank you. It's for everybody to be included. Everybody's got to be tested. Besides just George Floyd thing and the murders of Black people in America, this hit the whole world. We have to deal with it now. And you have over 70 million people that voted for the opposition. And now, you know, the incoming president, he wants to reach out to them and include everybody. They didn't want to include us. Forget them. And if he had a handled the virus halfway right, he would have won. But the American people saying that they didn't handle the virus right, he acted like it wasn't even there. But they live a life that we don't even dream about living. What could they care about us?
What struck me so much about that is Arundhati Roy speaks to that this pandemic we will move through it, but what it looks like on the other end will be dependent upon what we do. And are we going to keep dragging these old institutions, these old ways of knowing with us? Or are we going to create something new?
Exactly. If you pull up James Baldwin and you pull up Malcolm, the young people today, we're fortunate to have, we can pull up this stuff on YouTube now, the speeches and everything. Baldwin at Berkeley, Malcolm at Oxford, the interviews and the life. And you take the new book that's out on Malcolm now, The Dead Are Rising. You can see where we came from, and it brings us right up to speed today. You hit it on the head, you know, with what you just said, Sky. And we have to deal with it. And we have Biden in there now. We got a chance to. You get this environmental thing straight now. He's going to try to put the man in a very difficult position. Just the other day, look what he did with Cuba. He put him on a terrorist list, the terrorist blacklist. And who knows, he's probably hit Iran before he gets out of office. That's how treacherous he is. Just like he executed that poor lady who's been in prison for 30 or 40 years the other night. And more is to come before he gets out of office.
Another piece that I've been returning to this year has been Naomi Klein's Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism.
Yes.
In which she makes the argument that it's in the middle of crisis, in the middle of the shock, it's hard to create the structure that will help us create a future of justice. But it is the people organizing, the people planning before these crises that then become really agents in what it looks like on the other end. Where do you see the organizing happening right now that is creating kind of these new ways or creative ways to realize justice so that as we move forward, we won't be stuck in the same place in the next when the next crisis hits?
Exactly. Another 10, 15, 20, 25, 50 years. That's for your kids. We have to make it right for them. But I like what you said. The struggle is still in the streets. You know, on the street corner. Malcolm said, let your blood run in the streets. That's what happened in Minneapolis. Overnight, they abolished the police. Defunding the police is on the table now. Put the funds in the mental health. Put the funds in the homelessness. Tuition-free education. Again, not only that, Medicare for all. Our neighbors to the north in Canada, they have Medicare for everybody. We're the richest industrialized country in the world, and we still don't have it. A bunch of old, half-dead white men running things, you know, we'll never get it. Look what happened in the Capitol the other day. The young lady out of New York, the Cortez woman, and Ayanna Priestley, they completely disabled them in the Capitol when they came in. They took a walking tour of the Capitol a couple of weeks ago that was by the Republican Party, members of the Republican Party. Yeah, the Republican senator out there giving them the white power sign. Down in Salem, the Capitol, last week there, you have one of the guys in the legislature open the door for him to let him in the Capitol. I don't want to use the word deep, but here in Portland, we had the mayor of Portland had to come down and ask a young black man, could he use his platform to say Black Lives Matter back during the summer? We accomplished more than 50 or 60 years since the George Floyd assassination than civil rights accomplished in over 50 years or 60 years. And that's not stretching it. I mean, you got the people in your world. I marched with a professor all summer long. I called some of my other friends, the professors and teachers in black studies. So I said, you guys come on down and speak from Lewis and Clark, you know, from Oregon State to Portland State. And some of the brothers and sisters came down and actually spoke at the Justice Center. An 82-year-old nun came all the way up from Mexico just to be a part of this. She would sit out there every night across it in the park on her walker and pass out pocket lawyers to the people. And the thing is, you know, these kind of movements, they're hard to sustain. Now we have to maintain them and sustain them and maintain them. It's real easy, you know, with the amount of people we had out in the streets. The riffraff is going to fall to the wayside. You don't have to deal with that no more. You have all positive people out in the streets. You have the real Rainbow Coalition that Fred Hampton started back in the 60s. It wasn't Jesse Jackson that started the Rainbow Coalition. He came up with that after Fred Hampton was assassinated.
Right. With that in mind, can you speak to the concept of radical or revolutionary alliances across identity? So, you know, one thing that we've seen again recently is kind of the level of state violence that may be specific to communities, but is absolutely connected. I'm thinking of kind of the level of state violence in the street, the police murders, and the brown people in cages on the southern border. Can you speak to what it takes to activate and engage those kinds of alliances and those connections?
Thank you for the question, Sky. I want to go back to the war on terror. Just the other day, Guantanamo Bay, it's still open after all these years. Those guys have been taking no man's land. Some of them indeed may never return. Well, the British knew it was bull. They got all their guys out of there. The Saudis knew it was bull. They got all their guys out of there. And then you got some defenders still there. I once ran into a human rights lawyer. She had been there 33 times. And she said it was so painful to her every time she'd go, she just couldn't go there. That said, and don't you think on the southern border, Obama was a choir boy? Oh, no, he wasn't. He was just about as ruthless as the guy we got now. But that said, you talk about the Southern Order, you know, and the Rainbow Coalition and the people that were started all this and that. Well, it was Fred Hampton. The Appalachian whites came and got Fred, took him down to Appalachian with him. A lot of people don't know, but Fred was a NAACP youth organizer and voter registration organizer, just like the late Cesar Abrams was down in Georgia. He was registering people to vote before he came in to be the chairman of the party. And Bobby Rush, the only man who was able to beat Barack Obama in any election, the only election Barack Obama lost was to Bobby Rush, who was the co-chairman of the Illinois chapter of Black Panther Party. But the only reason they didn't dust Bobby Rush that night because they couldn't find him. And they had a bogus warrant out for him that came to light. But they intended to dust both of them that night. But get back to the Southern bubble. What's going on down there? You know, it's against all laws of human rights. They don't care. The conditions, some of those places are like the real banana republics, original banana republic. Well, we control all that. We invade them at will. Like I said, we got 800 military installments in over two-thirds of the world's countries. Now, you know, they're looking at us now. How can you come tell us about our problem, show us how to fix our problem? And you got, right now, we got National Guard in the Capitol. So right now, 20,000 National Guard troops are encircling the Capitol. Biden can't even catch the train in Washington. They got to bring him in probably in an armored car to square him in. The country brought this on themselves. They put a fascist in charge. What is it? Fascist in, fascist out. Just like in the computer, you put garbage in, you're going to get garbage out.
Thank you. Both in the Panther program and in your work, it always prioritizes the unification of body and soul. Londa Nelson's text, Body and Soul, beautiful piece. Can you speak about the significance of the relationship between body and soul to your organizing work and the significance of it to continuing this work in our current context?
Thank you. Thank you. I like that question. I was just telling the students out of Pacific University, the struggle is still in the streets. You know, you got to let your blood run in the streets. We hit the streets, and the people will see us out there every day. If you don't have a quarter to buy a newspaper, we'll give you one. We have a meeting here tonight. We see them on the street corner. Johnson had relocated 80% of the Vietnamese population and still couldn't win the war. Bombing people with no air defense. This is not me talking. This is our Senator Wayne Morris from Oregon. He's passed away now. He used to come and visit the People's Health Clinic that we started. Seen him speak in 1964, Scott, probably a little before your time, at the Memorial Coliseum where the Trailblazers used to play. And he said, they're bombing people with no air defense. He said, you get in a land war in Asia, half of them going to come home in body bags. And I've been there before, 60,000 of them didn't come home in body bags. But it's because of the people that hit the streets in the Vietnam War, the people that rode it out in Canada. Over 100,000 people went to Canada right out the Vietnam War. The minute Carter became president in 1976, 2 weeks after that office, he pardoned everybody that went to Canada from the Vietnam War. Anyway, I'm saying all that to say this. The struggle is still in the streets, just like since Murrow Day, George Floyd's assassination, when he hit you had op-eds in the Washington Post, the New York Times, and until we get this Palestinian thing straightened out, they're going to stop building those settlements over there. Just the day before yesterday, the big man over there, won't even call his name, 800 more settlements, taking these people's land away. Same thing they did in Northeast Portland with the gentrification. I was invited to a panel down in Portland State with a guy down there, and he wrote A Spineless Careerism. You know, the head of the Black Studies Department down there, I was supposed to be on the panel with him down there and to talk about gentrification. Well, I said, okay, where were you, man? You were down there over 50 years. You studied this. You knew this was happening, but you told nobody in the community about it. Now you're retired, you know, you got this, boom, you got this, you got this. Now you want to talk about a gentrification. It's too late now, Sky. It's much too late. It's gone. And so I said, no, I'll text him back. And I said, I've seen who's all on the panel. But this guy here, I said, I just don't do. And I didn't bite my tongue on it. You know, we get blacks in position of power and influence, but nothing ever changes for the rank and file down on the street going on. Nothing ever changes for us. Oh, we get food stamp, maybe a little, since the virus, we get a little this and a little that. You know, a grocery card or a grocery box or something like that, a U.S. bank card. But nothing ever changes for the rank and file on the street. Cooperative America has failed black people. Look at the homeless problem. I don't know whether you've been to Portland later. Go down by the Coliseum. Go down by the Rose Garden. cut off on any freeway, Sky. You can see what the problem is. I don't need to tell you. Your eyes is open.
I want to thank you so much, Dr. Ford, for your time here today. I just appreciate so much your ability to make connections that are so key to make and seem so challenging for some people to make these connections. And so I really just appreciate the scope of the connections across history and across communities that is so necessary for us to make a future.
Thank you. Thank you.
So thank you. Thank you again, Mr. Ford. It's as always, it's been an absolute pleasure. This has been Sky with the Old Mole Variety Hour.
That concludes our program for this morning. It is a collective labor that brings you the Old Mole every Monday at 9 a.m. Thanks to our Old Mole contributors and guests, Bill Resnick and Tara Hurst, Jan Hawken and Destiny Houston, Sky Wilson and Kent Ford. You heard about two events this morning, the Inaugurate Justice Rally, March, and Caravan that will be held on Wednesday, January 20th at Irving Park in Portland. That'll be 4 o'clock to 7 p.m. And on Friday, January 22nd, Portland State University and the Portland State University Foundation hosts an online panel on the 48th anniversary of Roe v. Wade. Panelist Loretta Ross, author of Radical Reproductive Justice, joins director Jan Hawken and physicians featured in the film Our Bodies, Our Doctors, and they'll be joined as well by attorney Leah Rutnam with the ACLU of Washington. They'll map the road ahead for reproductive justice as the right-wing Supreme Court seems poised to overturn Roe v. Wade. For more information on that event, please go to the Road Ahead for Roe Facebook event page. This has been Denise Morris for The Old Mole. We'll see you next week.